Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's Halloween, so careful out there. Pay attention. Slow down, especially if you're a young driver. Young drivers, that's always like, go slower than you think you have to. Well, not all. Some young drivers are so careful and cautious, but if you're like me, give it an extra 10 miles slower than you think. You're going to get home all right. Won't have any trouble bumping into a ghost or a goblin on the way home. Jimmy Akin is our guest for this Halloween show. And it's weird questions for Jimmy Akin. And there is an endless supply of weird questions for Jimmy Akin. I believe we could go forever and there would be an endless supply of weird questions. Jimmy, thanks for coming back.
Yeah. Cy Kellett, I want to compliment you on your extra Halloweeny spooky home studio there.
Come on, Jimmy. It's because my lighting is not quite right here in the home studio. We've got the black background.
In the wide shot, it's even orangey with that light you got.
With that light there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know. But at least I didn't put a pumpkin face in here. Actually, the wall is covered with black cats that have been cut out of cray paper, but you just can't tell because the wall is black. So it's actually beautifully decorated for Halloween, but it's textural, not visual. Yeah. If you could feel it, you'd know. I'm trying so hard. I'm fighting the urge to give out the number because all the questions are in already. We've got a bunch of weird questions for Jimmy in, and I want to get to one because I'm kind of glad we're starting off with this one. I feel like with this name, you say Basil. I feel like if it's a spice, you say basil, and if it's a person, you say Basil. No, do you have
There was Basil Fawlty.
Yeah, and Basil Rathbone. Like, I feel like Basil is how you say it if it's a person.
I just watched Basil Rathbone in some movies recently.
Some spooky old movies?
Well, one of them was, depending on how you count them, maybe more than one. I've watched multiple Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes movies.
Oh, yes. Right.
But then I also watched Son of Frankenstein. And he plays Wolf Frankenstein, the title character, the son of Frankenstein in that.
Is that one of the old Universal Frankenstein movies?
The second Frankenstein movie.
Yeah.
The third Frankenstein movie. The second is Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah. With the hairdo. One of the greatest hairdos. That and Marge Simpson, the two greatest hairdos of the media age. All right. I want to get to this question from Basil then. Not Basil, okay. Basil. Is prayer similar to telepathy? Do the saints in heaven communicate telepathically?
Okay. So let's deal with the first question first. Is prayer similar to telepathy? And here we need to distinguish between two different types of prayer, because there is mental prayer, where you say the prayer in your mind only, and there's what you could call physical prayer, where you also articulate it using your vocal tract. So if you say the Lord's Prayer out loud, that would be what we're at the moment calling physical prayer. But if you say the Lord's Prayer in your mind only, then it would be mental prayer. Okay, so let's talk about, now that we have that distinction in place, let's talk about telepathy. Telepathy is one of the three forms of extrasensory perception, or ESP. Now, let's talk about extrasensory perception. Extrasensory perception is the acquisition of information without using the physical senses. Okay, that's why it's called extrasensory perception. In Latin, extra means outside of. It does not mean in addition to. It means outside of. And so extrasensory perception is a perception outside the senses. Meaning the physical senses. So if you're acquiring information without using your physical senses, that's extrasensory perception. Now, Cy Kellett,
yes.
Apart from the incarnation, does God have physical senses?
No.
I mean, does he have eyeballs or no. Smell or anything like that?
Nope.
Okay, so if God gets information, it by definition on God's part is extrasensory because he doesn't have physical senses. So right there, that tells you that God's using ESP to, if he's hearing our prayers. Now, there's also another option philosophically that, you know, maybe he knows them, you know, because he causes them. But even that is, and so he just knows them by his own nature. But even that does not involve the physical senses. And so that would be, the extrasensory perception of, that would be the extrasensory possession of knowledge. Now, let's think about the types of ESP that exist. And parapsychologists have identified three major types. The first type is what's sometimes called clairvoyance. Clairvoyance is getting information in real time about a distant or hidden location without the physical senses. So remote viewing is an example of this. But the basic idea is you're getting information about a place. It's maybe a distant place that your physical senses don't reach, or it may be a hidden place that your physical senses don't reach. But one way or another, it's your mind is getting information about a place. So you can think of clairvoyance as mind to place contact. Then there's precognition, where you get information about the future. And the future is a time. So this would be mind to time contact. So we've got mind to place contact for clairvoyance and mind to time contact for precognition. And it doesn't have to be the future. It can also be the past. Sometimes that's called retrocognition. It's also just sometimes lumped together with precognition because it looks like the same ability. They're just pointed into different times. Then there's telepathy, where you get information about what another person is thinking or feeling without using the physical senses. And you can think of that as mind-to-mind contact. So we've got the three forms of ESP: mind-to-place contact or clairvoyance, mind-to-time contact or precognition, and mind-to-mind contact or telepathy. So let's think about when you, Psychelet, say the Lord's Prayer in your head.
Okay.
You have it going. You have the Lord's Prayer in your mind, and God knows about it, right?
Yes.
So you have mind-to-mind contact with God. He knows what your mind is thinking, correct?
Yes.
So prayer in this case is not only like or similar to telepathy, as Basil asks, it is telepathy.
Aha.
Under this definition.
Right.
What about if you say the Lord's Prayer out loud? Well, if you say it out loud, God, you know, he's omniscient. He's going to know you're saying it out loud. But once again, is God getting that information through physical senses?
No.
No. So no. It's still telepathy. So when you're praying to God, it's always telepathy based on this very simple, broad definition of telepathy with that, mm-hmm. that doesn't presuppose how the telepathy works or anything like that. What about the saints in heaven? Basil asked, do they communicate telepathically? Well, that's going to depend on your theory of how they communicate. And one of the things that medieval Christian thinkers like St. Thomas Aquinas and others did was use angels as a model for what the disembodied human soul can do, because angels are by nature disembodied spirits. And so they're disembodied intellects. And so if you can figure out what an angel can do, then you can figure out in principle, that a disembodied human intellect might be able to do the same kind of stuff. And so medieval thinkers used angelic intellects as a model for what disembodied human intellects can do. So do we have evidence, Cy Kellett, from Scripture of angels being able to communicate with each other?
Yes, absolutely. We do.
Yeah, we do. For example, in the book of Daniel, Gabriel shows up and relates how he and St. Michael have been coordinating a fight against the demonic prince of Persia together. And that would suggest that they can communicate. We have other evidence too, but that'll suffice. So it would seem that angels can communicate. And in doing that, angels only are intellects. They don't have physical bodies, so they don't have physical senses. So any communication that angels have with each other must also be telepathic. And here we come to an interesting fork in the road, because there's more than one kind of telepathy. One form of telepathy would involve broadcasting your mind to another person.
Okay.
The other would involve just knowing what another person is thinking, even though they're not trying to broadcast it to you. So if someone has to think and say, Cy Kellett, get the message, pick up Bart, and you hear that, however, incoherently, I mean, you might not pick it up perfectly. I'm saying pick up Bart, and you might hear it as pick up Bart. What does that mean? You know, but you still heard it. I was broadcasting it to you. On the other hand, if I'm just sitting here at home thinking, oh, I bet Cy Kellett wants pizza right now, and you just know that without me trying to send it to you, then that would be the more kind of receptive telepathy.
Yeah.
Now, here we come to a difference between what St. Thomas Aquinas thought and what some others have said. Aquinas picked up on a particular, and he wasn't the only one, but he picked up on a particular verse in the Old Testament that says, God knows the heart. And the implication is other people don't know the heart. And so Aquinas thought that the receptive telepathy, where there's no one's trying to broadcast it, he thought that doesn't happen, that only God has receptive telepathy. And so he said that in order for one angel to communicate with another, the angel had to broadcast its mind or reveal its mind to the other angel. So mm-hmm. he believed that angels had broadcast telepathy, but not receptive telepathy. Personally, I am utterly unconvinced by the argument that he proposed for this. The reason is that I don't think he and the other people who took this verse the same way are recognizing the literary context and what the biblical author was trying to say. The biblical author was not addressing the question of, do angels know each other's minds? The biblical author was making a point about humans, and humans generally do not know each other's hearts. But that's not to say they never do. It's just, in contrast to God, they don't have the same kind of knowledge of each other's hearts that God has. And so I think that it's, and furthermore, there hadn't been research done into telepathy in when the biblical author was writing. So I think they're stretching the text beyond its what you can reasonably infer from it. Just like you shouldn't try to get other scientific lessons from the biblical text, which is not trying to answer scientific questions. And in fact, once parapsychology did develop as a science, we got evidence that the receptive form of telepathy does exist with humans, that there are situations where no one's trying to broadcast to you, but you may still know, my child is in terrible danger, I have to rush out and save them, even though the child was not trying to broadcast to you that they were in terrible danger. So I think, I don't find the argument that angels only have broadcast telepathy persuasive. I think both humans and we have evidence that both humans and angels can have the more receptive form of telepathy. So I would say angels in heaven do communicate via telepathy, however you conceive that, on the broadcast only model or on the two-way model. When it comes to humans, I would say the same thing. I think humans in heaven communicate telepathically. And I would say we have it since in this life, we have evidence that humans can do two-way telepathy, that rather than just broadcast telepathy, I would say that saints in heaven can do that as well. That's my opinion. That's not a fact, but that would be my opinion based on the evidence we have.
Basil, thank you so much. What a fun and interesting question for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We got to take our first break this hour, but we'll be right back with more Weird Questions for Jimmy on this Halloween on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is Restless. It's four zany Catholic young adults seeking God in the midst of this crazy mixed-up world. They discuss life, relationships, work, fun, and everything else in our world through the lens of our Catholic faith. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And it's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin today. We've got a whole bunch of weird questions for Jimmy. Jimmy Akin, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He has one of the most listened to documentary podcasts anywhere, and that's Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And now he's got a second podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast, growing in popularity. And then he does our show, and he does a bunch of other people's shows, and he also answers people's email and does work. So I don't know how he does all of that. And occasionally he comes out with a new book. So are you working on anything? Got any books?
No, I was working on it mere minutes before we came on live today. Oh. So yes, I do.
And any hint what it's about, or are you one of those authors doesn't talk about it until
it's about religion.
Okay. All right. Well, in a general sense, then I know what it's about.
It's about a teacher of strange things.
Oh, I know that guy. That would be Jesus. Yeah. All right. Back to the weird questions we go. Brianna wants to know, human beings have no memory of their time as infants or their time while in the womb.
Not usually.
Is it possible that during these times, God has the ability to communicate with human beings and they can understand and respond? Or if certain things about our lives were revealed to us, but once we cross a certain threshold in time or development, we can no longer remember these things?
Okay, so Brianna has asked a question of the form, is it possible that God can do X?
Yep.
Specifically, she says, is it possible God has the ability? And then she fills out what the ability she's interested in is. Psychelet.
Yes, Jimmy, I know where we're going. Yeah, go ahead.
Every question that can be placed in the form, is it possible that God can do X, has a presumptive answer.
Yes,
what
it does.
What is that presumptive answer?
Yes, he can.
Yes, he can, because God is omnipotent and therefore can do anything that is logically possible. So the only way that a question of the form, is it possible that God could do X, would have the answer no, is if whatever X is involves a logical contradiction. So let's look at Brianna's question. She wants to know if it's possible that God has the ability to communicate with human beings in the womb and that they can understand and respond. Psychelet, does that proposition involve a logical contradiction?
None that I can spot, no.
Okay. And she then says, if certain things about our lives were revealed to us, I assume she means in the womb, but once we cross a certain threshold in time or development, we can no longer remember these things. Does that idea that we once had some things revealed to us that we can no longer remember, does that involve a logical contradiction?
Nope.
No. Nope. So I would say both of these are possible. It's possible that God could communicate with people in the womb. They could understand and respond. But then after a certain point, they cross a threshold and can no longer remember those things. So I would say, yeah, all that's possible. The question I would have is, what evidence do we have that this is the case? And of course, one, it's hypothetically possible that that we have no such evidence because this scenario involves us forgetting the information. So we wouldn't, on this scenario, we wouldn't remember the things God had revealed to us. And therefore, it would not be, it would not be something that we could falsify, which would mean this is not a question. And well, I'm not going to pull science into it, although I'm tempted to, because falsifiability and science are very closely related. But it's possible that this is an unfalsifiable situation, at least directly, unless God told us that he revealed stuff to us that we then forgot. And notice, he doesn't have to be the one causing us to forget. We could forget for other reasons, you know, like our, as part of our developmental process. In fact, there's a concept we may get to later called childhood amnesia, that where we forget stuff. But unless God told us that he had done this, we wouldn't have knowledge of this. Also, it could be possible that maybe the forgetting process isn't 100% bulletproof. Maybe some people do remember things that God had revealed to them when they were still in the womb. So I'm not closed to the, I think it's possible that this could happen. I would just want to see evidence that it happens. I don't have any evidence that God has told us this happens, although I haven't done a survey of, you know, looking for it. I know it's not in the Bible, but it could be in private revelations. I know there are some people who claim to remember things from when they were in the womb, but thus far I don't know that any, I don't know what I think about those, because like a lot of the claims involve hypnotic regression, and hypnotic regression is not actually a good memory booster. It promotes confabulation. And so if the evidence of for people knowing stuff when they were in the womb is merely derived from hypnotic regression, I'm not going to give it a lot of credence. I would want to see more evidence, but in principle, I'm open to this as a possibility.
Brianna, thank you very much. RoboSquid 2518 is next. And RoboSquid wants to know this. If you could go back in time to any time period, what event would you try to change the outcome of, and how would you do it, assuming that changing the past is possible?
Well, this is a really difficult question for me to answer, because I can, my first impulse is to say I want to do the most good possible. And so I could say, well, I would want to go back to the fall of mankind and stop Adam and Eve from falling. Okay, so how would I do that? Well, I don't know exactly. It would depend on the tools I had. Like, could I even speak the same language as them? You know, exactly. You know, the historical reality that corresponds to Genesis 3 is something that involves symbolism, which the church has acknowledged. So at least some elements of it are symbolic. And so I'd have to see what's the situation on the ground when I got there. But assuming that I had the ability to change the past, that would kind of be my first guess. Problem. Psychelet, you may be aware of a line in the church's liturgy on a certain day of the year that refers to the fall of man as felix culpa.
Yes. Oh, happy fault.
Oh, happy fault. Right. Why do you think they call it that?
That brought us such a great savior.
And a greater destiny than the one we would have had if we had stayed in the garden.
Right.
And so in terms of the church's liturgy conceptualizes the fall of man as a net positive, that it, even though it definitely involved a lot of bad stuff, namely all of the moral evil and a lot of the physical evil in the world's history, it nevertheless is a net positive because God is going to bring a greater good out of it. So this teaches us the law of unintended consequences. And so that makes me say, even though my first instinct would be to go right to the root of the problem and change the fall of man, maybe I shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And so that opens the door to a principle we're going to talk more about on the other side of the break.
All right. Hang on, Robo Squid, if you can. More coming up on Time Travel with Jimmy Akin. It's Weird Questions on Catholic Answers Live.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
A little bit of groovy music there for you. I know Darren's just trying to butter me up, make me feel better, because we never got the weird questions music. Did you notice that, Jimmy? We didn't ever get any weird questions
music. I didn't notice that. I like the groovy music, though. I also have a theory about where you are in your secret bunker.
Okay. Where am I in my secret bunker, Jimmy?
I think you're in Collinwood. I think that you're in the Collinwood Mansion in Collinsport, Maine.
You think I'm a vampire? Is that what you think?
No, you're just surrounded by dark shadows.
Yes, I am surrounded by dark shadows today. I don't know what to say about it. It is a little spooky. I see myself and I think, let's cut from me to Jimmy. So let me go back to Robo Squid's question. He asked if you could change anything in history, what would you change? You said, well, you probably want to change the fall of Adam and Eve, but no, you wouldn't want to change that because a great good came from that great evil.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I could propose any number of things, you know, go back and change the Protestant Reformation, go back and change the Crusades, go back and change any number of things. But if you want to do the most good, my instinct would be go for the root cause of all the problems, which was the fall of man. Okay. But if it truly is a happy fault or felix culpa, then maybe I shouldn't do that. And the same thing is going to be true of any other application of the of trying to do the most good. You know, if I tried to change the Crusades or if I tried to change the Protestant Reformation, who knows what would have happened? I mean, maybe if I stopped Martin Luther from launching the Protestant Reformation, Muslims conquer Europe. Or maybe if I change the outcome of the Crusades, you know, China invades the world and imposes a totalitarian. I mean, there's just no way to know. And so I'm not God. I don't see the big picture. What I do know is that God would, and the Catechism says this, is God would not allow an evil to exist if he wasn't going to bring about a greater good. So I can trust that even though history unfolded in ways that it contained some unfortunate things, the result is going to be greater than if those mm-hmm. things had not been allowed to happen. And so who am I to change them? So I certainly wouldn't try the to do a greater good application of changing the past, which means I might, you know, I still would need to consider some other things, like, you know, maybe I would change something not for purposes of the greater good, but just for my own convenience, you know, or my own preferences. Like if I had a cure for colon cancer, I certainly would be tempted to go back in time and give that to my wife before she died and save her life. On the other hand, my life would have taken a very different course. And like I said, I'm not God. I don't see the big picture. Even maybe God brought about a greater good through, among other things, one aspect of that greater good, maybe the fact that I have the career I do and I'm helping people in all over the world, you know, that might not have happened if my life had assumed what I would have chosen. So I don't know that I would choose to change anything. On the other hand, and that's assuming that time changing the past is possible, which RoboSquid presupposed. He said, assuming that changing the past is possible. So if you asked me, what would I change? I might be tempted to change something for my own personal preference, but I don't know that I actually would. I might not change anything. On the other hand, let's alter RoboSquid's question a bit. He presupposes I can go back to any time period and choose where I'm going and what I'm going to change. Let's change the first part of that. Let's say I just go back in time and I don't have control over where I am. Would I, in that circumstance, refrain from changing the past? Remember, we're assuming it's possible. Well, if I'm transported to before my lifetime and changing the past is possible, world history will alter. Because if I wasn't originally part of this timeline, let's say I'm transported back to the year 1600. So that's 400 years ago. Well, if I wasn't a part of the original timeline for 1600, and then you drop me into it, and then it's possible to change the past, and that's going to have ripple effects going forward. And in 400 years, the mere fact I existed in this new version of 1600 is going to spread out, and it's going to affect everything on the planet in 400 years. That means none of the people that I knew in 2025 in the original timeline are going to be born in the revised timeline. Oops. Because human identity is determined in part by the particular gametes that come together on the night a person is conceived. And even though women have only one gamete that's ready for a conception, men have hundreds of thousands of gametes that could be ready for that one conception. And so if our parents had done anything different on the night we were conceived, I mean, anything different, a different pair of gametes would have come together and there would be a different person than us in our place. And so in 400 years of dropping Jimmy Akin into the year 1600, the ripples of that are going to affect everyone in human history. So that means I can't avoid changing history if I'm just transported back into the past. And if I can't avoid changing history, then what are my moral obligations? I can't stop the change. Everyone in 2025 is going to be different. So I would say that if I'm just transported into a changeable past and I don't have control over where I go, then I may as well do in 1600 what I would have done in 2025, which is the best I can.
Oh, yeah.
And so if I have, I want to do the most good I can in 2025. So if you transport me back to 1600, I want to do the most good I can in 1600. I can't change, I can't avoid change in the future. So I may try to make it the best future I can. So for example, if I, in 1600, there's no penicillin, I know the basic principles of how to make penicillin. I mean, I know it's bread mold, and I know it's used to treat a variety of infectious diseases. So I, in 1600, just off the top of my head, would introduce antibiotics. I mean, I'd have to experiment a little to find the right strain of the bread mold, but I would know how to find it. And I would, and that would improve human life. There would be plagues that decimated people that would not happen in the revised timeline, or at least would not be as bad in the revised timeline. I also know about the atomic theory of matter and basic principles of electromagnetism. I would begin development of electronics to make people's lives better. And if there are particular political events, now my knowledge of the 1600s is not as great as some other periods. I deliberately picked 1600 because it's not immediately before the Reformation or the Civil War or World War II or anything like that. It's a time period I don't know much about. But if I knew of particular events that were bad, I would do my best to change them. I also would be working within the constraints of the time period I'm in. Even though I have a lot of knowledge that could bring good, oh boy, do political situations get dicey. You know, I mean, John Dee, Queen Elizabeth I's advisor, was allowed to have conversations with angels and do all kinds of stuff that were regarded as magic. But that doesn't mean Jimmy Akin's going to be allowed to do all kinds of stuff with his magical germ theory and atomic theory of matter and antibiotics and electronics and stuff like that. So I'd have to be very careful in working with the situation I'm in, and for my own self-protection. But within those constraints, I'm going to do the most good I can. And so I would say I would do the same thing in principle in 1600 or wherever I ended up in time as I would do in 2025, which is try to do the most good I can given the circumstances I'm in.
Robo Squid, thank you very much for the question. That actually gets us right to the break. So we'll take a quick break and come back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on this Halloween on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilino with a few words about St. Jerome. Praised as the greatest Bible scholar in the ancient world, St. Jerome translated the Bible not just once, but several times. Breaking new ground, he promoted consecrated life for women and involved these women in his work.
Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being here with us. Don't forget, drive extra carefully tonight. If you're in the car, extra carefully. A lot of little people out doing their thing tonight, collecting their reward for knocking and saying trick or treat. And let's get them home safe. It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. And this one comes from Maximilian. Do Daleks have souls?
Daleks.
Sorry. Dude, wait, let's try that again. Darren, just cut that out in post. Okay, just cut that out. This one comes from this one.
We don't have post on a live stream.
Ah, shoot. Do Daleks have souls?
Well, okay. So Daleks, for people who may not be aware, are a race from the science fiction franchise Doctor Who. Which goes back to 1963 in Great Britain. And in fact, the Daleks were introduced in the second Doctor Who story. Daleks look kind of like big salt shakers, or sometimes in British documents, they'll be referred to as looking like pepper pots, not the Iron Man character, but you know, kind of like a salt shaker. And people often assume they're robots, but they're actually not, as established in Doctor Who and the Daleks, the second Doctor Who story ever. They're actually living creatures. In the second Doctor Who story, the Doctor goes to a planet called Skarrow, which is inhabited by two races, the Khaleds and the Daleks. The Daleks are mutants, as we later learn, that branched off from the Khaled race. And they actually, these days, they look kind of like icky green squids, kind of like that. And they move around in these salt shaker shaped or pepper pot shaped travel casings. So, which have various accoutrements like a plunger and a ray gun that'll zap you dead and stuff like that. So they're really living creatures. They just use an exoskeleton to move around. And so, Sykelet, the historical Christian opinion on living creatures, other than humans, does it involve them having souls?
Yes.
Yeah, it does.
Living things have souls.
This has always been the case in Christian history. In fact, even in pre-Christian history, the Greek philosophers like Aristotle understood the soul to be the life principle of a physical body. And so any living organism has a soul on Aristotle's view. And Christian thinkers like Thomas Aquinas adopted that view. There's even biblical support in that some animals are referred to as having souls in the Old Testament. So both in the biblical conception, although there's some nuances there, and in the philosophical conception, any living creature has a soul, which is why they're alive. As James chapter 2 says, the body without the spirit is dead. So it's the soul that keeps something alive. So since Khaled mutants or Daleks are alive, they would have souls. Now, that wouldn't tell us whether or not their souls survive death. On that question, there's been a difference of opinion. Some thinkers have been of the opinion that you need a rational soul for your soul to survive death. That was Thomas Aquinas's view, for example. But that's not church teaching. That's just his opinion, and it's based on philosophical arguments. A while back on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, I did a review of those arguments, and I didn't find them convincing at all. We also have actually empirical evidence that suggests that animals, at least some animals, have souls that do survive death. So I didn't concur with Aquinas on this point. And I think that that we need to be pretty generous in terms of who we allow into the afterlife. I mean, it's God's choice, so we shouldn't be too presumptive about this. When it comes to Daleks, now obviously they're fictional creatures, but they are rational creatures. In fact, they are very smart. They were able to basically battle the Time Lords to a standstill in the Great Time War, the greatest war in the history of the universe. And you don't battle the Time Lords to a stalemate if you don't have some smarts. So I would say they look like rational creatures. They may be evil, just like the devil is a rational but evil creature, but they look rational. And so I would say, even on Aquinas' theory, we should assume not only do they have souls, but they also should have an afterlife in which they would get their just comeuppance. However, due to their genetic programming, God would take it into account the fact they were programmed to be evil, and he would be merciful to them.
Maximilian, thank you for that question. And it being Halloween, let's do another ghost question. M. Jewel 84.
I'm not doing Dalek ghosts, not at the moment.
No, but we have established that they have a ghost.
Yeah.
If we assume ghosts are real, M. Jewel 84 asks, why would they even exist? Why would God allow a soul to stay on Earth? Doesn't that go against everything Christ taught about what happens when humans die? How can one reconcile the Christian afterlife with ghosts?
Okay, so M. Jewel uses a rhetorical device that I don't particularly find helpful. M. Jewel says, doesn't the idea of ghosts go against everything Christ taught about what happens when humans die? Psychelet.
Well,
did Christ ever say a human soul can't manifest on Earth?
No.
Did Christ say a lot about what happens when humans die?
He did not.
Before Judgment Day?
No, he did not.
Yeah. Anytime someone uses the rhetorical device of, doesn't that go against everything about X? The answer is almost always no. The people use this, it's a form of exaggeration. People will say, if you propose a particular theory, let's say a scientific theory they don't like, they'll say, that goes against everything we know. Well, no, it doesn't, because not everything we know concerns this theory. And here we have a theological theory rather than a scientific theory. But in general, whenever people use go against everything rhetoric, it's almost always false. And usually people have stopped thinking at that point. They haven't carefully considered, well, what evidence do we really have? And what would it contradict, if anything? A person may have an impression that Jesus taught that the souls of departed humans never manifest on Earth, but he didn't say that. So whenever I encounter go against everything rhetoric, my counsel is to wait a minute, hold on, let's set that rhetoric aside and step back and take a calm look at what the evidence actually is. And frankly, Jesus does not say that human souls can never manifest on Earth. Now, M. Jewel, so let's proceed through M. Jewel's question, setting that rhetoric aside. The first part of the question is, if we assume ghosts are real, why would they even exist? Because they're human souls. That's fundamentally what a ghost is, a human soul or spirit. In fact, ghost is just the a Germanic word. In modern German, the word is Geist, but it English is a Germanic language, and we got ghost from the same root. What that means is the same thing we use the Latin-based term spirit for. In Latin, spiritus means ghost, and ghost means spirit. So a ghost just is a human soul, and the Christian faith, including Jesus, teaches that human souls exist. So obviously ghosts exist in some sense, or they just exist. M. Jewell then says, why would God allow a ghost to stay on earth? Okay, now M. Jewell is presupposing an idea that isn't necessarily part of the general conception of ghosts. M. Jewell is presupposing that when a human dies, their spirit stays on earth. That's different than their spirit manifesting on earth. Their spirit may not be on earth, but they're allowed to appear here. And so there may be an apparition of the ghost, just like I can see you, Cy Kellett, here in Fayetteville, Arkansas, because you're on my screen. So I have an apparition of Cy Kellett, even though actually you're in San Diego, California. And having an apparition of Cy Kellett is perfectly appropriate for Halloween. I won't comment on how scary it is, but
I
have an apparition of Cy Kellett. Now, so the same thing could be true of ghosts. The ghost might be in heaven or purgatory or hell, and yet they could appear to the living on earth just the same way the saints in heaven do. In fact, you can call the apparition of a saint from heaven a ghost. We don't typically do that in colloquial English, but you could, because it's a spirit of someone in heaven. Spirits also, disembodied spirits, don't have a literal location. Various thinkers like Aquinas would say you can analogically or metaphorically describe a disembodied spirit as being located in the place where it's manifesting. So if a ghost is manifesting in your house, you could describe the ghost as being present, but it's not physically here. Ghosts don't have, spirits don't have physical dimensions, and so they don't occupy physical space as long as they're disembodied and not tied to a body. So I would say that's how one can reconcile the Christian afterlife with ghosts. We have spirits, they continue to endure. Whether they are in heaven, hell, or purgatory, it's possible for some spirits to manifest to those on earth in the form of an apparition. That doesn't mean they occupy physical space here on earth, but it does mean that they can, by God's permission, do things that have effects here on earth. And one of the reasons that that may happen is because they're, if they're a purgatorial ghost, then they can be working out things they need to process and get through as part of their purification on their way to heaven, like asking for people's prayers or asking for mass to be said for them or saying I'm sorry to those they wronged in life or saying I'm okay, you know, I'm going to be fine. You don't need to be afraid for me. And so there are a lot of ways to reconcile the idea of the Christian afterlife with ghosts. They don't contradict each other. And fundamentally, historically, the most common Christian theory of what ghosts are is that they're usually, not always, but usually purgatorial ghosts.
All right, M. Jewell, thank you. Jimmy, I want to leave you enough time to answer this.
Okay.
It's going to take a long while, I'm sure. Grant wants to know this. Do you go clockwise or counterclockwise when praying the rosary?
Well, of course, one can do either, or something can one can do something else. And most of the time when I pray the rosary, I do something else.
Oh.
Most of the time, and I only mention this because I'm asked about it, I don't try to show this off, but if I'm using a physical rosary, I tend to go clockwise. But normally I don't use a physical rosary. I use my hands. And specifically, I use, and it can be either hand. I can do it with my left hand or I can do it with my right hand, but I count on my hand because, you know, there are 10 Hail Marys in each decade of the Rosary. I do the same thing with the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, but I use the American Sign Language numbering as a sign of solidarity. Oh. So I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Well, that is not what I was expecting from that answer. Grant, thanks very much for the question. Thanks, everybody, who got us questions for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin.
And Jimmy, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. Thank you. That will do it for us. I'll say it one more time. Please drive carefully with those little people out there. A lot of them don't know what they're doing. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.